Welcome to Power Play. I'm Evan Solomon. Coming up on the program, disconnected from reality. Damning testimony says Donald Trump knowingly spread conspiracy theories to undermine the election.
The big lie was also a big ripoff.
There was never an indication of interest in what the actual facts were.
It was nonsense, BS, bogus, just some of the words used as Trump's former attorney general destroys the president's conspiracy theory that the election was fraudulent. What else emerged and where does it all go now? We'll get the latest from the Washington on the January 6th insurrection hearings going on today. Then, looming mortgage meltdown.
Mr. Speaker, we understand that affordability matters to Canadians, and that is why we have already taken action.
One in four of Canadian homeowners say they could be forced to sell if rates keep rising, according to a new survey. Is Canada set for a mass mortgage default? Is today's market meltdown another sign of a looming recession? We'll bring in the deputy economist from the Canada Mortgage Housing Corporation. That's the national housing agency. You want to hear from these folks. Are they worried about a housing crisis? I'm looking forward to that. And Mendocino's Emergency Act confusion.
So did the minister invent these facts to support his liberal power grab?
You heard from Commissioner Lucky herself during her testimony before the committee, Mr. Speaker, that she said, quote, the Emergencies Act was necessary. It was necessary.
Did the public safety minister, Marco Mendocino, mislead Canadians when he said the government invoked the Emergencies Act on the advice of police forces, or was he misunderstood? Why are some calling for his resignation? MPs are going to debate that issue. Plus, Canada's big Russian blunder, Trudeau's COVID sequel, and does Canada have a conspiracy pandemic? All that today on Power Play. Let's get to the players. Detached from reality. That is just one of the stunning descriptions of the president, President Donald Trump, from his former Attorney General, Bill Barr, guy who used to support Trump, as he topped a fascinating day two at the U.S. House Committee hearings on the January 6th Capitol riots. The committee drilled down on what the Democrats call the big lie, which is the false claims from President Trump that the 2020 presidential election results were stolen. Today, even Trump's own former team seemed to turn on him. Let's bring in CTV News Washington, D.C. reporter Rich Madden on that. Rich, first of all, awesome to see you. What a day today.
You too, Evan.
What did we learn today?
Yeah, I mean, look, the committee is really trying to drill down and connect the dots that President Trump whipped up his supporters, knowingly spread this falsehood that the election was rigged, and encouraged his supporters to come to D.C. on January 6th and egg them on where they stormed the Capitol in that deadly riot. So today was really getting a window and insight into what happened shortly after President Trump lost the election last November, in November 2020. His former campaign manager, Bill Sepian, described it this way. There was Team Normal and Team Crazy. Trump's own top officials, including Bill Barr, insisted that these conspiracy theories were bogus. There was no truth to them. And the president just kept flaunting more and more conspiracy theories. And finally, Bill Barr just said he had enough, according to this deposition on video. Take a listen to this.
I was somewhat demoralized because I thought, boy, if he really believes this stuff, he has, you know, lost contact he's become detached from reality. If he really believes this stuff. On the other hand, you know, when I went into this and would, you know, tell him how crazy some of these allegations were, there was never an indication of interest in what the actual facts were.
So that's just Bill Barr, Evan, the former attorney general. We also heard from his replacement when he resigned, saying the same thing, echoing that the president refused to listen to reality. Instead, he would listen to people like Rudy Giuliani, who committee member Liz Cheney said was apparently inebriated when he was chatting up and amplifying these election lies on Fox News and other media outlets. So really, we got an insight into what was happening in the Oval Office. We had a president that was told repeatedly that what he was saying was bogus. There was no evidence, but still he kept spreading that lie, encouraging his supporters to storm the Capitol or to come to D.C. on January 6th. And of course, we know what happened in the hours that preceded.
Yeah, amazing to hear how spinning Bill Barr was, saying this was just, he just didn't listen to the facts. Then there was some alarming testimony, real quick, Rich, from an election official about how what the Democrats called the big lie was weaponized against him. What happened there?
Well, and this is real world consequences, Evan, when the former president starts saying the election was rigged and then he starts attacking people and naming them. We saw what he did with the Secretary of State in Georgia. And today, Al Schmidt, he was an election worker in Philadelphia. When he refused to say that there was election fraud in his state, Donald Trump tweeted at him, naming him in a tweet. And this is what he experienced. Take a listen.
After the president tweeted at me by name, calling me out the way that he did, the threats became much more specific, much more graphic, and included not just me by name, but included members of my family by name, their ages, our address, pictures of our home, just every bit of detail that you could imagine. That was what changed with that tweet.
As you say, real-world consequences, and then, of course, what happened on January 6th, maybe the most real-world. What should we expect next? That was day two of the hearings. What's next?
Yeah, so the committee is going to continue. So today, really laying the groundwork as to what was happening in the Oval Office. They painted a picture knowing that Trump knew that what he was spreading was wrong, but was a lie, but he continued to do it regardless of the consequences. So as we approach into the next committee hearing, which is supposed to be slated for Wednesday, we're going to hear more along those lines. Look, Evan, I'm really curious to see what was the thinking in the Oval Office that led to that crazy press conference at Four Seasons Total Landscaping in Philadelphia. I think you can remember that towards the end of November, and when Rudy Giuliani and Sidney Powell and the rest of the cast of characters really got hold of this information, of this disinformation, and just spread it to the masses. Yeah. So that's coming up on Wednesday. But the real uphill challenge for this committee, Evan, is to get Americans to pay attention. This country is so divided, the ecosystem is so fractured, and many Americans have simply made up their mind, whether it be Donald Trump or whether they believe that this election was stolen. So this is a challenge that the committee has to continue. Can they continue to grip the American public? It's an open question, Evan, whether they can continue to engage with the Americans and perhaps move the needle on what the Americans' thinking is of Donald Trump and the fact that he continues to still fundraise millions off Americans into these bogus causes, even though he's not in power, he's not president, but he continues to amass millions through fundraising.
Yeah. And there's the politics and there's the facts. And the fact is nothing has proven, as Bill Barr said, that that election was fraudulent. CTV News, Rich Madden in Washington. Fascinating day two there. Thanks, Rich. But if there's a battle for truth in Washington, as Rich has just told us about, there's a battle for truth in Ottawa right now, this time over the government's controversial use of the Emergencies Act during the trucker protest. Conservatives are alleging that Parliament was misled, and that the Minister of Public Safety, Marco Mendicino, knew that, so much so that leadership candidate Pierre Poilievre is calling for Minister Mendicino's resignation. Here's why. In the aftermath of the protest, in fact, even before it, the minister repeatedly said that the police forces asked the federal government to invoke the Emergencies Act. He said that the government was acting on the advice of police forces. Here's just three moments in the House of Commons where Minister Mendicino explicitly said that police gave advice to the government to use the Emergencies Act. Check it out.
We invoked the Emergencies Act after we received advice from law enforcement. We debated those facts in this House. I remember my honourable colleague and I having an exchange during the debate of the invocation of the Emergencies Act, and it was only after police told us that they needed this special power to ensure that they could restore public safety. We continue to listen very carefully to the advice that we're getting from our police services, who say that the Emergencies Act is instrumental in having addressed the blockades at ports of entry and continues to be instrumental in preventing them.
Okay, so those in February saying that. But remember, at the committee hearings on the use of the act after it was all over, the former Ottawa police chief, Peter Slowly, and the current RCMP commissioner, Brenda Luckey, explicitly said they did not ask the federal government to invoke the Emergencies Act. Check this out.
Did yourself or anyone in the OPS request the invocation of the Emergency Act?
I did not make that request. I'm not aware of anybody else in the Ottawa Police Service who did.
As a law enforcement agency with primacy for national security, did you ask the government or representatives for the invocation of the Emergencies Act?
No, there was never a question of requesting the Emergency Act. There was a question...
Sorry, I don't mean to interrupt, but I'm sorry. So you never asked for it. Do you know of any other police leadership that asked specifically the government for the invocation?
No, we actually reached out to various police agencies when there was talk about some of the authorities within that they were proposing. And, of course, we were consulted because we were the ones who would be using those authorities. So we were consulted to see if they would be any of any use to police in these in the context of the Freedom Convoy.
Okay. Just last week, though, the Deputy Minister of Public Safety, a guy named Rob Stewart, told the committee looking into this, that the minister actually was misunderstood. So the new line from the government is that the police didn't maybe specifically ask for the Emergency Act to be used, but they wanted the powers contained in the act. Well, if that was the case, why didn't the minister actually say that? So is it all a misunderstanding, or is it an act of misleading? We did invite Minister Mendocino onto Power Play. We were told he's not available today, but we do have MPs here. Parliamentary Emergency Preparedness Parliamentary Secretary Yasser Naqvi is here. So is the Conservative Public Safety Critic Raquel Dancho and the NDP Public Safety Critic Alistair McGregor. Welcome all. Mr. Naqvi, I'll start with you. You've got February 21st. Minister saying we must follow the advice of police on this. February 21st, we will follow the advice of police who are telling us the act is still necessary. May 2nd, the minister, at the recommendation of the police, we invoke the Emergencies Act. The police say they didn't. Did the minister mislead? Why was he saying that they recommended it when no police force thus far has said that?
Well, Evan, thank you very much for having me on the show. As you also probably know, and listeners may not, that I'm also the member of parliament for the riding, the area where the 3 week long occupation took place. And as many would remember, this occupation lasted for very long, 3 weeks, with drastic impacts on what was happening in the downtown core in terms of our businesses being closed and residents being harassed in downtown Ottawa. And it was very clear that there was no end in sight. During this whole period, the government, of course, was in contact with, getting briefings and consulting with law enforcement officials to better understand the situation on the ground and to find ways to put an end to this occupation. And in that course, there was advice given as to the kind of gaps law enforcement was seeing with the nature of that occupation and the evolving nature of that occupation that resulted in blockades around many key crossings across the country. And the government acted on that advice by creating special orders under the Emergencies Act that allowed for law enforcement.
Minister, I don't want to relitigate. I understand why your government thinks it's justified, but the argument here is that the minister said, I just want to know if this is a true statement, and you're a lawyer, I know you understand this, sir, Marco Mendocino, February 21st, we follow the advice of the police and other experts who are telling us that the act is still necessary. We will use the measure... we must follow the advice of police. We know the Ottawa police didn't give him advice to use it, and nor did the RCMP. Is it true that any police force said we need the act? And if so, why isn't your government telling us which police force asked? Because if there is not a police force, why did the minister say that?
The advice that was that the law enforcement officials that were giving, both in terms of Ottawa and other crossings, is the kind of tools they needed to put an end to the occupation. And if you look at the Emergencies Act order, you will see the very surgical approach, very prescribed specific powers that were charter compliant, that were given to police. And the proof is that the occupation came to an end, that the police were able to use those tools and the resources to put an end to the occupation. And that was exactly the intent.
But I'm just going to ask you one more time. Again, I'm not asking if it was effective. I just want to make the minister said we must follow the advice of the police. February 21st. Can you tell us, did the police advise the minister to use the Emergencies Act? Yes or no? That's the heart of the issue here. What's the answer?
Well, Evan, in our system, the police is responsible for operation. The politicians don't dictate as to how to do it. What our responsibility is to listen to our law enforcement, and if they identify gaps in tools that they need, then we meet those, we fill those gaps, and that's exactly what happened in this case with the invocation of the Emergencies Act.
Raquel Dancho, was it misleading, or is he just simply misunderstood that, in fact, as Mr. Nakvi said, look, they said they were in trouble. They interpreted that they need these new powers, and they did it. And in the end, the RCMP didn't ask for it, but they said they were actually necessary to help end the protest.
You know, Evan, I think this is very concerning for Canadians that the Liberal government is misleading on 9 or 10 occasions now, including the Prime Minister of this country has misled Canadians about the invocation of the Emergencies Act. And that's something that we should all be very concerned about. The Emergencies Act, let's remember, Evan, is one of the most powerful laws in the land. It has the full ability to infringe on charter rights. That's why the threshold to invoke it is extraordinarily high. The Liberal government has failed to justify that invocation. And as a result, we believe that's why they've been misleading the public by saying, oh, the police asked for it. Oh, there were arsons connected to it. We know that's not true. It was foreign funded. We know that's not true. Oh, there were guns there. Oh, we know now that's not true. Every single thing that they have said to justify the invocation of the Emergencies Act has been disproven. And now we know on 9 or 10 different occasions now, the Minister of Public Safety and the Prime Minister have told Canadians that the police asked for it, and we found out that that's not true either. So it's deeply concerning on something so significant that they've been misleading the public, Evan. It's unacceptable.
But now when Brenda Luckey, the RCMP Commissioner Raquel Dancho, said we didn't request it specifically, but it was very helpful to us and it helped end the protest. The government saying they needed powers. This has gone on for 3 weeks, and it was critical in resolving the issue. You don't buy that? You don't think that's what he was saying when he was saying that we were acting on the advice of the police?
I think consistently they've said they needed the Emergencies Act, again, the most powerful law in the land, to commandeer tow trucks. Evan, we know that there are laws on the books that you can commandeer tow trucks, that police have access to getting tow trucks to remove vehicles parked illegally, for example. We know that the blockades at the various different border crossings were cleared without the emergency powers. So again, it is ridiculous to suggest that laws in Canada don't exist to clear protests. We know that that's not true. And that's why the Liberal government, we believe, has been misleading the public by trying to pull in all of these false truths or mistruths, and has been using these as justification when we know now that that's not true. It's disappointing and concerning.
Okay, but I just want to, let me just get to the NDP just for time. The RCMP, I'm just going to, Mr. McGregor, your party has supported the use of the E, and I'm interested to see if you feel you were misled. But again, the RCMP commissioner said, we are not in a position to provide influence on the government as to when and when they should invoke a certain act. For us, it was about keeping Canadians safe. They're not saying that they ask or not. They said it's not our job to do that. Does your party feel they were misled?
There were multiple systems failures that went into this, Evan. We had a declaration of local emergency from the city of Ottawa. We had the provincial state of emergency, and then the feds finally acted on February the 14th. I think that the minister certainly has some explaining to do. Our support for the Emergencies Act at the time was based on the best available information. But in the absence of any clear explanation, the government does owe it to the Canadian public to be clear. And that is why we have both a review committee of parliamentarians and a public inquiry. And my colleague on the committee, one of the co-chairs of that committee, has been very clear that cabinet needs to come clean and they need to provide a full accounting of the decision process that was in place that led to the invocation. I also don't think that
the conservatives have some
revisionist history on this as well. You know, for them to just say that a couple of tow trucks were needed, I think completely ignores the seriousness of the situation that was present in Ottawa and the way that residents,
your party,
business owners, and workers suffered.
But let me just push back. Your party voted for the use of the Emergencies Act. So you thought that the threshold to use the Emergencies Act, your party thought that it was reached. Are you now saying that that was the wrong thing to do, that the threshold wasn't reached? So, and if it wasn't reached, why did your party then vote to utilize the very act? You were there, you saw the situation, your party knew about it. So are you saying that was the wrong thing to do, to give the powers to vote for the use of the Emergencies Act?
No, I'm not saying that. Our vote on that day was a confirmation of whether the invocation on February the 14th was done in the proper way. The choice I made then was the right one. What I am saying, Evan, is that with all of these questions about whether the minister got accurate police advice or whether they asked for it, what that demands at committee is a full airing of cabinet documents. And that's precisely what my colleague Matthew Green has been pushing for at the Emergencies Act Oversight Committee. So now the onus is on the government to come clean on that front.
Okay, so I just have 10 seconds. Mr. Nakvi, will your government reveal the cabinet documents? I've asked this to Marco Mendicino, the minister, as well. So this can be cleared up. It seems like a very critical confusion here.
Well, so I also sit on that committee with on Emergencies Act, and there has been a production of document request that has been made. I believe that we have given the government 30 days to produce documents. Of course, when it comes to matters of cabinet confidences or solicitor-client privilege, government has to make certain decisions in that regards. But we look forward to receiving the documents that have been requested.
Okay, I know we're going to talk more about this. Ms. Dancho, Mr. McGregor, Mr. Nakvi, always a pleasure to have the three of you on the program on a critical issue. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has just tested positive for COVID-19 for the second time. He's just returned from the Summit of the Americas in California on the weekend. So now this is twice he's testified. I know some people think it's three times, but he had isolated before when his wife, Sophie Gregoire Trudeau, initially had tested positive, but he never did back then. So this is two confirmations. He's tweeting that he's isolating. I feel okay, he says, but that's because I got my shot. So if you haven't, get vaccinated, and if you can get boosted, do it. Let's protect our healthcare system, he writes, each other and ourselves. Also, an update today on those long lineups at passport offices across the country. Federal Minister responsible, Karina Gould, says there's no short-term solution for the delays. And Canadians need to be patient. Check this.
At this point, we're receiving a far greater volume in terms of applications than what we have capacity to process. However, we've been putting changes in place since April that, you know, are helping to make this process more efficient. But I can't unfortunately give you that date. What I can give you is my assurance that this is my number one priority, losing a lot of sleep over it because I know Canadians are too.
Minister Gould says 85% of applications are for brand new passports, mostly for new Canadians and children trying to travel for the first time, which she says is a big reason behind these extraordinary delays. Coming up, is Canada headed for a mortgage meltdown? Could you see a mass of homeowners defaulting on their mortgages as rates go up? We're going to bring in a really key voice that you don't want to miss. This is the deputy economist at the Canada Mortgage and Housing Corporation. This is their issue. You don't want to hear from anyone else. They're next. Mortgage free fall? Look, there's a new survey out from Manulife Bank of Canada showing that homeowners are feeling deep pressure from the rising interest rates. Get this, one in four homeowners say they'll have to sell their homes if the rates climb much higher, and they will. This comes on the heels of the Bank of Canada saying many home buyers are financially stretched and they're stretching themselves to purchase property due to the fear of missing out. A little FOMO going on there. Then today, the TSX composite entered a massive correction territory. The composite index fell more than 2%, with its subgroups trading in negative territory. So things were horrible on the markets. What does it all mean for homeowners? Is Canada staring down a looming recession or maybe mass defaults? Now, to really dig into this, we want to go now to the Canada Mortgage and Housing Corporation Deputy Chief Economist, Aled Abiorworth. Mr. Abiorworth, first of all, great to have you on the program. And I know you're a Crown Corporation, and this is what you follow. So I know you can't comment on anyone else's survey, but I want to ask, is Canada Mortgage and Housing Corporation, CMHC, concerned about mass defaults on mortgages if rates go up?
We're concerned, yes. Defaults tend to occur later, but what we're concerned about at the moment is just the overall state of the economy. Inflation is high. The Bank of Canada is raising interest rates. That will put pressure on a lot of households to service their mortgages. They'll be cutting back on other expenditures, slowing down the overall economy, and it makes life very uncertain at the moment.
The idea that a quarter of households may have to suddenly sell because they can't afford it is remarkable. There'd be a mass turnover there. Is that something that CMHC is so concerned about that a huge number, like a quarter of homeowners, are going to have to sell their house, or a fifth of them, I guess?
Well, it's a tough call at the moment. I mean, what we're anticipating at the moment is that house prices come back down. We're not anticipating a crash at the moment, but just a steadying of prices. Now the problem is that the situation is pretty risky. The high levels of debt make the Canadian economy extremely vulnerable to these mortgage rate increases, and that's really what we're keeping an eye on. Predicting in the short term what will happen is really tough, but it's this trend towards higher debt that's really giving us pause, and why we've been consistently saying we need more housing supply to try and improve affordability over the long term, so we don't get everybody sort of rushing out into debt.
But if higher rates, is there an anticipation from CMHC that the market's going to deeply cool, and if people start selling because rates are going to go up, does that mean house prices are about to fall?
Well, it's a tough call. In the short term, yes. I mean, we're anticipating quite an economics slowdown. Whether it's a recession or not, it's too early to call. But what we're seeing over the very long term is just this trend towards higher incomes, greater population growth, and this sort of long-term structural demand for housing. And when you combine that with a lack of housing supply, affordability is a problem. And it's sort of always going to be there, given that we're not producing enough housing. Now, you know, what that situation also implies is that we get this extreme volatility and risk that we're now seeing, people chasing after housing, getting too much debt, and then these risks that are becoming apparent in the economy.
So look, there's fears of a recession. There's fears that higher rates will make it owning the house unaffordable. People can't pay for their mortgage. They're going to sell. People are concerned right now. They're looking to the CMHC. Just in a nutshell, are things perhaps more volatile or worse than was anticipated earlier? And what do you foresee ahead in that market? What is CMHC foreseeing in the housing market coming up?
Well, I can make it a little bit more concrete. In 2021, we saw quite a rise in house prices, particularly in the period after COVID. People were moving out to get second homes. They were moving out to the countryside. They were searching for larger places to live. So you saw prices really rise in places like Ottawa, Halifax, Hamilton, up the Fraser Valley from Vancouver, and they went up significantly. We would expect in those cases prices to come back down, and potentially, but by large amounts. So, now, other places, Toronto, Vancouver, it's just it's very unaffordable. And in those places, the situation could be quite different. So it's going to be very market specific, where in some places you can have large decreases. Other places it might be a bit more nuanced.
Well, it's volatile, all right, and rates are going up. Canada Mortgage and Housing Corporation Deputy Chief Economist, Aleb Abiorworth, thank you, sir. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
All right. We're trying to get you. I know there's a lot of concern about mortgages, a lot of concern about rates. We're trying to give you the people that really that's their main thing. Coming up, why did a Canadian official attend a Russia Day event at the Russian embassy? I thought Canada was supposed to be isolating Russia, not going to parties. We'll find out next. And we'll be joined by a Ukrainian MP who's in town to get their perspective. Stay with us.
I'm as mad as her because this should have never happened. And of course, Mr. Speaker, this will not happen again. Of course, I'm the minister and the buck stops here, but what I can tell you is that we've been showing leadership on the question of Ukraine. Our intent has been the same since before February 24th. We need to make sure to send a strong message to the Vladimir Putin's regime. We need to suffocate it diplomatically, economically, and politically.
Minister of Foreign Affairs is on defense and damage control mode after news came out from the Globe and Mail originally that a Canadian official attended a Russia Day event at the Russian embassy in Ottawa. Supposed to be isolating Russia, not attending their parties. But as you saw in the clip, the Foreign Affairs Minister says it was unacceptable for a Canadian official to have attended a Russia Day reception. What message does it send to Canada's Ukrainian allies? And as the war rages on, is Ukraine even getting the aid that Canada's promised? Let's bring in a Ukrainian MP. She is in town now. Yevhenia Kravchuk, she's the deputy chair of the governing servant of the People's Party. She is in Ottawa to meet with ministers and MPs. MP Kravchuk, thank you so much. Before
thank you
we
for
get
having
to
me.
What's going on in your country, were you disappointed that a Canadian official would actually attend a Russia Day ceremony at their embassy?
Actually, I couldn't believe that it's true that the embassy is, you know, doing the party and someone attending. So, yes, of course, it was very strange for me. And honestly, I think that the Russian diplomats, they're actually spies. In all of the embassy, like 90% of them are FSB agents. So I think that Russian diplomats had to be sent home. and many other countries did already. They sent numerous numbers of these spies to Russia. And I think that's the only response. But actually, you know, a member of parliament, I was elected by Ukrainian people. And Ukrainian people are actually asking about when the Western countries will give us weapons. And that's, you know, for me, it's the most essential thing, frankly speaking.
Right. And I want to get to that. But I just as you were asking for weapons today, Ms. Kravchuk, did you raise with officials and ministers that the Ukrainian government is displeased that a Canadian official would even attend an embassy party like that?
Well, it was good that the reaction came yesterday, and the Minister Julie already had the reaction, because I was contacted by our Ukrainians that live in Canada, and they were really displeased, asking, you know, questions. So it's a good thing that the reaction, at least, was right. Fast enough.
MP Kravchuk, first of all, we know that you've tweeted out that in your home city of Kharkiv was hit by 4 missiles as you were traveling here. So first of all, we hope your family is safe. What does Ukraine need now? Because Russia is taking more and more areas in throughout the entire Donbass region. And they say they look like they may start controlling it. So what is the situation there and what does Ukraine need right now?
Yes, you are right. When I was flying to Canada, Russia was bombing my hometown in Western Ukraine. And Western Ukraine is relatively safe. My 8-year-old daughter is okay. But the girl from Kharkiv who fled the war from Eastern Ukraine, she's 12 years old. She was wounded in this attack. And the attack was at the residential buildings. For us, the main things that we need to ensure that Russians do not occupy even more our land is heavy weapons, which is artillery 155. And actually, this caliber Canadians can provide, and they're already committed to do that. But we need that on the ground. We can't have that on the paper. We need that on the ground. And also, we need the howitzers, the MLRS systems. We understand that now Canada doesn't have a lot on the stocks. But there are money in the budget for this purpose. So the money can buy the military, the heavy weapons to stop Russians. Because at some parts of the front in Donbas region, Donetsk and Luhansk, we are outnumbered in heavy weapons 1-10. Russians just brought all of that stuff to one region because they want to have at least some victory.
We are following this closely. I know you're here to continue to raise the critical awareness. The fight is raging on. We would just like to say our thoughts are with the Ukrainian people who are dealing with a horrific invasion, and every day the daily battle rages. MP Kravchuk, thank you so much for raising awareness on this program. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me and raising the issue. It's been 110 days. We cannot forget that the war is still there.
We will never forget the war is still there, 110 days and counting. Thank you. Coming up, a life sentence with no chance of parole for 25 years. That is for Alec Manassian, the man responsible in the deadly Toronto 18 Toronto van attack. What does this decision mean to the victims? We'll talk to CTV's Adrian Gobriel next. Stay with us. The man responsible for the deadly 2018 Toronto van attack has now been sentenced to life in prison, no chance of parole for 25 years. Alec Manassian, found guilty last year of 10 counts of first-degree murder, 16 counts of attempted murder for driving that rented van down a busy sidewalk in Toronto on April 23rd, 2018. 10 people tragically died that day. They were killed by this guy today. An 11th died 3 years later from injuries suffered in the attack. Manassian was in court today for the sentencing hearing, face-to-face with survivors and victims' family members who one by one read the victim impact statements. CTV's Adrian Gobriel is outside of the Ontario Superior Court of Justice in Toronto now. We know the sentence, but it was emotional. Adrian, can you describe what you heard from the victims and the families as they addressed the court today?
Yeah, definitely an emotional day inside the courthouse, Evan. At times during the victim impact statement, sobbing could be heard throughout the courthouse from survivors, from the victims' family members. There were so many powerful victim impact statements, just, you know, a couple of them. We heard from Anne-Marie D'Amico's mother, Camilla, and she spoke about her daughter and how her life has been forever changed. She spoke about how after Anne-Marie was murdered by Manassian, she was going through her daughter's items, and she found a note written by Anne-Marie, and it was a list to herself that said, things I want to do before I die. As we now know, she never got to complete that list. We heard from Geraldine Brady's daughter, Janice. She tried to call her mother multiple times on that day in uptown Toronto. She called not once, but three times, couldn't get a hold of her mother, drove to her mother's house in uptown Toronto, went inside the home. The house was empty, save for a half cup of tea that was left on the counter. She ran down the road where she saw two bodies covered by orange tarps on Yonge Street. At the time, she didn't know about one of those victims was her mother. Some really difficult times today in the courthouse. You know, for these families, it's been more than 4 years since the attack, and this sentence was delayed as we waited for a Supreme Court decision. And, you know, it was, you know, very clear that the emotions, the loss is still so very raw for the victims, the survivors, and many people, you know, here in Toronto and in parts of the country.
Yeah, all over the country. Just 4 years, Adrian, and just powerful, devastating testimony in the courtroom in those victim impact statements. CTV's Adrian Gobriel in Toronto. Thank you, Adrian. Appreciate that. Very difficult day in that court. Coming up, millions, that's right, millions of Canadians believe in conspiracy theories. That's according to a new survey from Abacus Data. This is an extraordinary poll they've taken. What can be done and what is the cost? You think this is only going on in the U.S., conspiracy theories about the election? Wait till you hear what this survey says. Press Gallery is going to dig into that next. Stay with us. Look, today American politicians are dissecting what the Democrats call Donald Trump's big lie. It would be prudent for Canadians watching not to be so dismissive about how much and how many people hold similar kind of views here in terms of conspiracy theories, believing things that just have no factual basis. There's a stunning new survey by Abacus Data today that breaks down how many Canadians could be under the grip of conspiracy theories. Here's what was found. They surveyed 1,500 people, and they found 20% of those surveyed think the World Economic Forum is a group of global elites with a secretive strategy to impose their ideas on the world. 37% say they aren't sure or it's possibly true. Conservative leadership candidate Pierre Poilievre says he would ban members of his government from attending a World Economic Forum, even though, by the way, Stephen Harper attended twice at least. Another conspiracy theory involving Microsoft founder and billionaire Bill Gates using microchips to track people has about 13% of Canadians saying this is possibly true. About 44% of respondents. That would translate into 13 million Canadians say big events like wars, recessions, and elections are controlled by smaller groups of people working against us. Can you imagine 13 million adults believe this? Another said 37% or 11 million people say there are a group of people in this country who are trying to replace native-born Canadians with immigrants who agree with their political views, essentially white replacement theory. So why is this also why is this so prevalent right now? How dangerous is this? White replacement theory, of course, has become one of the more dangerous rallying cries in places like Charlottesville, North Carolina. Is this a disturbing trend in Canada? And what do we make about it? Ian Bailey is a reporter with the Globe and Mail. He also writes for the Globe's Daily Politics Briefing. And Tonya McCharles is a senior reporter with the Toronto Star's Ottawa Bureau. Good to have you back. Ian, I'm going to start with you. You know, we see a lot of polls, all of us. I actually thought this is one of the most alarming polls I've seen, just the amount of people who believe in conspiracy theories that have no fact. What do you make of it, and what's the consequence of this?
Well, you know, there are some Canadians who are going to be obviously very distressed by these results. There are some Canadians who are going to be reassured by these results. Obviously, the replacement theory material is obviously very concerning. It's it shows, I guess, that we are not necessarily so different, or that there's as much concern here as there is in the United States for some of these views. Government will work with things like online hate legislation there, but it remains to be seen if there's any way to legislate your way out of these kinds of beliefs, to push back on them, and basically what to do. The Conservatives are obviously in the middle of a leadership race, and some of these issues are being litigated there, and we'll see in due course where that party lands and how that affects the political discourse.
Litigated, utilized all over the place, Tonda, as Ian talks about that.
Well, exactly.
I thought this was such a stunning level. What did you make of it, Tonda, as you've watched this?
Yeah, no, the numbers are astonishing. I agree. And I suppose we've been warned for so long about, you know, people who do believe conspiracy theories, people who are breeding, you know, foment and belief in things as ludicrous as replacement theory. I think that to see the numbers that Abacus is reporting puts a real policy challenge in front of not just legislators, lawmakers, politicians. I think it also, we must all recognize it's a challenge for all the other institutions that support our democratic system, be it the police, be it the courts, be it the media. I think that everybody has to take note of this. And to Ian's point about not being able to legislate your way out of it, that is perhaps true. Certainly some legislation can go some way around helping combat online hate. But it remains to be seen if they're going to be successful in that. There are many objectors to it. So, I'm not sure what the answer is. I do think that there's a real responsibility on policymakers and on elected politicians and officials running for high office, high Democratic offices, to be responsible in their messaging, to be authentic in their messaging, to be truthful to Canadians. And I think that can go some way to perhaps addressing some of this distrust.
44% of respondents, Ian, say big events like wars, recessions, and elections are controlled by small groups of people. That's 13 million adults. You know, this is going to grind the gears of democracy, of governments, media, scientists. I mean, we've seen distrust as an abstract thing. There's hearings in the United States right now that show it becomes a concrete thing pretty darn quick.
You know, having seen these numbers in the last bit, there's no solution that comes quickly to mind. But perhaps it is helpful to have this on the table, to have some numbers out to sort of fuel this debate, which had been going on before this and clearly will go on after this. So maybe that's the only good that comes out of this, to sort of have this out there for all, as Tonda said, for all parties, and not just political parties, but institutions to be mindful of as they go forward.
But we can say that, Tonda, but it's happening. Look, I know, the hearings in the U.S. real quick, Donald Trump say, he was warned by Bill Barr, the attorney general, then this is BS, didn't matter. You're seeing it in Canada. There are people running around saying that the WHO is going to take away powers from the Canadian Parliament, which is just not true, but it's happening.
We've seen irresponsible statements come from people in places where they should know better since the beginning of the pandemic. You know, statements against Dr. Theresa Tam, who it was suggested she was acting for China, and statements about, in the first instance, where the pandemic came from. And then in the second instance that once we finally did get vaccines that we can't believe in them. And look, it's been, I think, a long, hard 2.5 years for everybody. But what we've seen in the results of this survey, I think, is in some measure, the outcome of people doing deep dives on the internet for hours and hours on end through the pandemic and coming up with all kinds of alternative facts to justify their thinking. And I think we saw that in the convoy, didn't we? When you talk to people about what was motivating them, what was driving them. And some of those conversations left me reeling.
Right. Yeah.
Tonda's absolutely right. I mean,
separate worlds. Unfortunately, I got to go. Ian and Tonda, great to have you, but we got to keep the conversations going. My goodness. That is Power Play Day in Politics. I really appreciate Ian Bailey and Tonda McCharles joining us. Thank you for watching. Remember, we'll be back here in 23 short hours. Hug your loved ones. Have a great evening and continue the debate. It matters.